Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking human rights. We are talking about human rights and what has happened over the last 12, 15 months during COVID. It is a topic, obviously, we come to a lot on the Tortoise Shack. We've covered it, many aspects of it, and we will be going to look at certain aspects of what have happened in Ireland next week with Liam Herrick of the Irish Council of Civil Liberties. But for today, we have a broad view, and we are absolutely thrilled to be joined via Zoom by European Media Director for Human Rights Watch, Andrew Strawline. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Look, I just to give us a quick... I've said it at the outset. Now we have seen human rights issues that you guys have been campaigning for since the outset. Have some of the stuff that's been done under the cover of COVID. Could I ask you, as the in your position, to give us a quick main points of what difficulties they have and what has happened that's undermined human rights issues in Europe over the course of the last 12 months under the cover of COVID, as I said?
Sure. Well, I think we've seen a lot of different responses from different governments across the European Union. We've seen everything from, you know, governments behaving relatively responsibly and taking up their obligation to keep people safe from a public health perspective, and instituting measures that are, you know, completely reasonable and on health grounds. Of course, it's had a huge economic impact on people, and not all the measures are accepted, especially as time goes on. People are getting, you know, more and more frustrated. But then we've also seen other governments, you know, you can think of Hungary, for example, and Poland to an extent, that have really used the pandemic as an excuse to deepen their authoritarian tendencies. Now, these are governments that, you know, have already.
In terms of Hungary, which obviously we've watched with great interest, particularly in terms of the party of government in Ireland for the last 10 years has been is a member of the EPP in Fine Gael, and they have only recently now have we seen Hungary has in effect have they walked before they were thrown, Andrew?
Yeah, essentially, you could sort of say that, although no one was really pushing too hard to throw them out. I mean, the European People's Party, the EPP, had many, many opportunities over many, many years to get rid of the ruling party of Hungary called Fidesz, and they weren't moving too quickly at all. And so eventually, it was actually the Hungarian ruling party that left them.
Yeah, I see, because I do recall a couple of years ago when if you remember, it was quite a big story in Ireland when the EPP, including Fidesz, voted to, how do we put this, to stop the rescuing of migrants crossing the in the Mediterranean. And it was quite disheartening when the Fidesz party, the Fidesz members in the European Parliament, cheered vociferously.
They're quite a horrible, quite a horrible bunch, actually. You know, and back home in Hungary, you know, this is a government that has quite literally starved asylum seekers in custody and things like that. They've really been awful on a whole number of different levels. But as you said, you know, they've used this COVID pandemic to kind of do a lot of things they may have already kind of been thinking of doing anyway, but in a more accelerated fashion. And now, you know, in the course of the pandemic, we at Human Rights Watch, you know, have said, okay, they've crossed a line there, and Hungary is really now a dictatorship, which, you know, inside the European Union is just it's just scandalous, and it's embarrassing for the EU, and the EU doesn't seem to be taking it very seriously, unfortunately.
Yeah, indeed, the EU doesn't seem to be that embarrassed about it at all, Andrew. Is there steps or actions that the EU should be taking that they're not taking?
Well, the European Parliament is the one institution that has been relatively good on this and has been trying to push the Commission in particular to take up its obligations. In particular now, they can push on holding back some of the budget that comes from some of the actual cash that comes from Europe to member states based on, you know, rule of law concerns. And there are many rule of law concerns with the current government in Hungary, obviously. So the parliament's been actually quite good in pushing. The commission has been at best dragging its feet. They really just don't seem to ever want, and not just this commission under von der Leyen, but before as well, under Juncker, they just don't seem to want to take this seriously. They try to, I guess it's kind of avoiding conflict or avoiding controversy or not making hard decisions. They really just try to get out of their responsibilities to uphold democracy. And it's good to see the parliament at least trying to push it.
Yeah, we saw also, and I don't want to, it's hard to just move on beyond Hungary, but we've also seen in Poland, human rights under attack in terms of reproductive rights for women. A law was brought in, they have now implemented what is, in a sense, a removal of access to reproductive healthcare for women. And that's also another dangerous thing. We've seen huge protests, but still, the government has proceeded and implemented these changes.
Yeah, that's right. And again, these are things that the government probably wanted to do anyway and was pushing on. And, let's make no mistake about it. Poland was very difficult for people realize their reproductive rights in the first place. It was not something that started with this government. It's always been quite traditionally against reproductive rights and kind of against women's rights or very difficult for people who are for promoting women's rights generally, let's say. So there's nothing new in that sense, but yeah, as you said, the government made a bad situation and made it even worse from the standpoint of reproductive rights.
Going to interrupt the podcast now because we have to, actually. That's why it's unbelievable amounts of people listening to these podcasts. There's an unbelievable amount of podcasts being produced. And we are, I think this week we're going to hit about 520 just on the echo chamber alone. We're seeing a third annual housing conference in Maynooth that we're going to be covering things that weren't possible a few years ago. However, you don't understand how tenuous it is. It's genuinely hand to mouth around here, and we need support. It's really that simple, Martin.
It is, Tony, and we're doing a lot of work outside of podcasting as well, which it all feeds off the door to check. I've done the podcast with Mick Clifford on bogus self-employment. These are all kind of civic stuff that we're doing outside of the Tortoise Shack, and I know you're doing it as well.
Yeah, but what frustrates me is this trying to, people keep, I get this awful thing where we're understanding why we do what we do, what we want to continue to do what we do, but it's very hard to square the circle of making it viable. I mean, there's no way we can have ads or sponsors. Actually, we're very ad and sponsor unfriendly, to tell you the truth. And that's telling listeners that they just not. Who's interested in people who are pulling against the establishment as vociferously as we are? But the issue remains that if this doesn't start to actually
turn a book, Tony. Yeah,
I it's not even turn a book. We have an opportunity here, I think, with people that we get to speak with and people to actually make impacts, and we've made impacts. You're in the PAC. We've seen there's things coming out of the last season of Policed that the Garda commissioner himself is involved in.
That's right.
There's actual fundamental changes happening in Irish society that we help to do, but it won't continue to go unless somebody puts their hands in their pocket and goes to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and helps us do it.
And I like the work we're doing, or like the work I'm doing with whistleblowers now, Tony, as well. Like, we've had Noel on, and we're going to have other whistleblowers on. These are people who have put themselves on the line to try and make things better in Ireland, and the only outlet they get is us.
I don't know what more I can add to it other than I really do hope, if you enjoy what you hear or if you get something out of it, that you'll give something back. Because realistically, there's a lot of competing aspects for people's money out there. I get that. But we're asking for the price of a coffee once a month. You know, a fancy coffee would be nice, you know, but we'll settle for a cheap coffee if that's what you want. And you get loads back in return. That's the truth as well.
That's the difference. There's an awful lot that comes back, a huge amount. I mean, as much as any radio station is turning out, Tony, on shows. And just to remind people where they have to go to become a patron of the Tortoise Shack, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and it's not expensive. It's really not. So if you want to see a difference, you're going to have to pay for it. It's that simple.
The other aspect of Poland, of course, is of course LGBT rights, that the government is also using, you know, LGBT people as a kind of scapegoat for all of the problems that they see in society or they imagine in society. And we had the development of the so-called LGBT-free zones, which, you know, were supported by the central government, different communities around Poland making these declarations against LGBT people, which was really quite horrible. And, you know, this is under, I guess, supported by another trend that this ruling party in Poland has been supporting, which is the complete undermining of judicial independence. So the courts have really become completely politicized, especially the highest levels of these courts have become completely politicized. And so rule of law is breaking down. It's, I'm not sure you call it a constitutional crisis or just heading into that direction, but it's really the ruling party kind of grabbing the different levers of power. Remember, they took over the media, they took over different institutions, and the courts have been central. Taking over the courts has been central.
Yeah, they have them
holding their grip.
They have, in a sense, actually stacked the court in with.
That's the way to put it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we always look across the water at the U.S. and say, you know, with the balance of power in the Supreme Court, which judges lean which way? But this was the same within the heart of Europe. I do think, just on a general sense, though, we've seen mass movements and we've seen a slide to the right in many of these movements, you know, where we've seen sort of the anti-mask movement. We've seen that the COVID 5G conspiracies. We've seen all of these things. How do you feel has the European Union managed to stand up to this kind of growing threat that I do call it a threat, because it is. I mean, we've seen even in recent elections in Spain where, you know, parties that would never have gained any traction at all are now coming in with enough of a vote to actually be involved in conversations that they wouldn't have been involved in before. People are calling it populism. I don't know. I think that word is kind of lost all meaning, but there seems to be a slide to the right and a crackdown. And a lot of it comes from sort of anti-immigrant. And then you move on to, you know, conspiracy theories. It's just to be flat out blunt about it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that. Have the EU and the member states like dealt with this very well? I mean, there's two things going on. First is like the outright just extremist far right parties that, you know, can get 5 to 10% of the vote in some countries and kind of always seem to be a threat and are always getting tons of media coverage, well out of proportion to their, you know, actual size. And you see sort of mainstream parties, usually the center right or on the right fully, and they're trying to adopt those policies, adopt some of that rhetoric. And really, you know, it's the threat is kind of like two-headed in that sense, right? So then on the one hand, you have these, you know, extremist parties that have these extremist ideas that don't believe in universal human rights at all. And they pose one threat. And then the other threat, maybe I would say even bigger, is that the mainstream parties just pick and choose from them, you know, these extremist ideas and these anti-universal human rights ideas, and use them and kind of mainstream them. And that's actually, in a way, you know, as I say, that's probably the bigger problem, that these things slip into the mainstream and become normalized, you know, and that's what we're fighting against. That's what we're very worried about in a number of countries.
We have one of the biggest refugee crises and a hunger crisis, global hunger crisis at the moment. Do you think the idea of a European passport, particularly when they're leaving it to individual countries to decide what way that's implemented, do you think there's a danger there that it can be used against refugees coming into Europe?
Well, I mean, they will never miss a trick to use every possible tool against, you know, asylum seekers. It's been shown that the European Union, the border agency Frontex, and the individual governments, many of you know, that are on the front line, are you know, to one extent or another, willing to use almost any tools. They're you know, doing pushbacks in the Aegean. They're leaving it up to Libya in the Mediterranean to deal with these boats. We just had another sinking with 100-something people dead, basically because those on the EU side said, "Well, not our problem. It's your problem. You deal with it." And you know, people get sent back to places where you know they're trying to escape from. I don't know, like. If the so-called green
just lost you, Andrew, sorry.
Green passes.
We're gonna sorry. Andrew, can you hear us? We've just lost you there. Sorry. Hang on. Have we got you there?
Or
no.
No, it's just...
Yep.
I don't know if that specifically will be.
Sorry, Andrew, we lost you there for about 2 minutes. Could we come back to where?
It might be. Will we try and move to the
Hello?
Vaccine? Yeah, we got you. You got us.
Sorry about that. This is just a bit of a disaster. This
we've had worse, Andrew. Don't worry
What I might do is I might come in with a question. Then you were talking about.
Don't ask a question about 5G, please. Honestly,
yeah. you were making a point though about the pushback. So maybe if you could just complete that point, then we'll go into the vaccine situation. And
okay,
we'll just,
sure.
Is that all right?
Yeah, sure. So I was just saying that the EU and member states, you know, particularly those on the front line, but not just those on the front line, have really been trying, been implementing every tool they can, and a lot of the tools they can't and shouldn't be anyway, to go after refugees and asylum seekers. It's been, you know, it's quite miserable to see that the European Union push back and, you know, its border agency encouraging or working with local authorities to push back people seeking asylum in the EU, and to see, you know, another boat disaster in the Mediterranean just the other day where over 100 people died. It's the situation continues, and the authorities in, you know, here in Brussels and also in, you know, individual member states are really not taking it particularly seriously, and they think as long as, you know, there's fewer people coming, then that's fine, and they're not really upholding their obligations under international law.
I do want to move us on. I'm conscious of time, and I know we've had some issues with the line, and I appreciate you bearing with us. I really appreciate you sticking with us. You have been very vocal yourself personally all over social media, and I would say we will tag your credentials on the podcast when it goes out. But the numbers on vaccines to the global south, and I'd be remiss to not mention that we spoke to Caroline Otham in Nairobi during the week, and she spoke about, you know, the very limited numbers of vaccines that are available to the Kenyan government to administer just to, you know, a couple of cohorts, and that's it. That's what they have. Do you want to just give us a quick flavor of how bad the situation really is? It's terrible.
Okay, where should I start? I think if we start with scarcity, now I think everybody who's been paying any attention at all over the last few months knows that there is a shortage of vaccines around the world, okay? There's a shortage everywhere, really, except maybe now the United States, but there's a shortage that basically means that people are not getting vaccinated quickly enough. Now, in some of the richer countries, or the countries with rich governments anyway, because, you know, we say rich countries, but obviously not everyone in those countries is rich. So that that's often a bad way to put it. In rich governments are able to fight for and get doses, obviously better than a lot of the low and middle income countries. This means that, you know, 83% or something like 83% of the doses given so far around the world have been, you know, put into the arms of, you know, people in like 10, maybe 10 rich countries. Hmm. Yeah. And like 0.2% in low-income countries. So there's this huge disparity. Now, that's one issue. But as I say, the scarcity actually exists everywhere. The scarcity of approved vaccines exists everywhere. And that's because production is limited. Obviously, if you don't produce enough, then, you know, you don't have enough.
It's a manufactured scarcity then.
Yes, but it's a manufactured scarcity. Yeah, and, you know, the manufactured part of it, this is a totally artificial scarcity. This is what, like, this is what's been, you know, engaging me so much on social media lately, but also, you know, so many others that are working on this, Doctors Without Borders and Oxfam and, you know, other organizations that look at the scarcity and see it's completely artificial. We do not have to have a scarcity of vaccines. We only have a scarcity of vaccines because governments in the EU, the US, the UK, Australia, Japan, Brazil, and a couple of others are literally blocking wider production of vaccines globally. Like, literally blocking. And they're doing this by obstructing a proposal at the World Trade Organization called TRIPS. And that, it's a TRIPS waiver, right? And what that would basically, these things are super complicated because it involves international property and international trade. But basically what it is a waiver on certain patents for medical materials for a limited period of time, just until the pandemic is over, to allow wider production in other countries, in other places, right? So that you could boost the production capacity in places like, I don't know, maybe Kenya, for example, since you brought that one up. And there would be greater global capacity. And then we could start to have, maybe we could get close to having the capacity that we needed to overcome this scarcity, and people could get vaccinated. The problem right now is that we are vaccinating people. We, the world, humanity, is vaccinating people at such a slow rate that it will take years to vaccinate everyone at the current rate because, again, of this artificial scarcity, right? So if it takes years, you know, the experts understand that, well, first of all, you don't need to be an expert to understand that a global pandemic lasting more years means more deaths and more economic disruption. But the epidemiologists and medical experts know that if it takes more than a year, or, you know, the longer it takes, basically, the more chance you give for new variants to emerge, new variants of the virus to emerge. Those new variants could be more deadly. They could be more virulent, spread more easily. And maybe most importantly, they could actually be resistant to the vaccines. Now, this is the current vaccines. This is something that the pharmaceutical companies admit. They say, you know, there's going to be new variants. We're going to need new boosters or new vaccines entirely to deal with these new variants. And the variants are emerging because we are not vaccinating people fast enough. So we need our governments to allow more production to get rid of this artificial scarcity problem. It's completely, as you say, it's a manufactured problem. It can go away. It's just absurd. It's an enormous scandal that this is happening.
And COVID, there is a COVID nuke going off in India at the present moment in time. But for years, India did produce off-patent and did bypass patent regulations. But over the past decade, there's been a huge pushback from pharmaceuticals and from other governments to stop India from doing that. Is that what we're dealing with now, is the aftermath of that, where India cannot produce to save its own people because of the economic situation globally?
It's not exactly like that, I think. So India is actually one of the places outside of the countries who are blocking the TRIPS waiver.
Yeah, it doesn't.
India is actually one of the only few. Yeah, India is actually one of the few that is actually producing vaccines. But the problem is, again, they're just simply not producing enough. And also, India had obligations to provide vaccines to other countries. But again, the problem is about not enough production capacity. So even if India was producing, you know, X amount, they needed, the world needs 1,000 times X. You know, this is simply not enough, and you know, not enough, not fast enough. And you know, there are many who argue that, you know, India should have vaccinated quicker and whatnot. I don't know the exact details of what's happening there, in terms of, you know, how India could have been could have approached this differently. But it's an example of, you know, how, what's going to happen and keep happening. You know, these flare-ups, you call it, you know, a COVID nuke in a way, but these flare-ups are going to happen, and you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions more people are going to die if this global pandemic continues longer than it needs to. We need to stop this virus. You know, the virus is laughing at us. It's just like it's like, oh, you're gonna come out, you know, with a toothpick, and the virus has a baseball bat. Like, what is this? Like, we are just not taking this seriously. It's ridiculous. Why wouldn't the governments of this world throw everything we possibly can at stopping this virus that's killing us and ruining our economy? It just, like, it is maddening.
Yeah, we did have Maho Rivas and Conor Reddy on recently, and you know, Maho talks about her family in Paraguay and how, you know, the inequality, and I suppose all of this comes back down to inequality yet again. It's, you know, because that's the driver here. You refer to the intellectual property, the TRIPS waiver, and you know, how that has to be lifted. I know there were noises from the Biden administration about lifting temporary waivers and lifting these things, but none of it has come to fruition as of yet. And when we talk about the inequality that's baked into this, that is the driver, really. It's they've taken public money.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. I mean, they've taken our money. They've made these vaccines, and then they're going to make another round of vaccines necessary because they're, you know, because of this tragic mistake of not doing the vaccine rollout fast enough. But you know, you talk about inequality, and like, this is what the pandemic has, you know, brought out on so many different levels. You know, so many people who were marginalized before the pandemic, you know, are even more marginalized now. Like, it has really brought people who were already in a generally powerless situation into a state of, you know, greater powerlessness. It's been just devastating in that regard, and also in a way kind of revealing. But the you know, there's a double edge to this, because the mentality that thinks that, oh, we'll be fine because we've got vaccines for ourselves here in whatever our country, our rich country that's been able to get hold of these, we'll be fine because we've had a vaccine program, we've bought enough doses, we'll be okay, is, you know, and saying, okay, well, the other parts of the world can get their doses later. That's really false logic that is incredibly self-defeating, because if there are still billions of people that the virus is circulating in, that means there are going to be more chances for mutation, more chances for new variants to emerge, which again could be more deadly, more they could spread more easily, and evade current vaccines, right? So then that's going to be what's necessary for another vaccine to be developed. And meanwhile, the vaccine that you've had is then made useless, and you and your family and everyone else could get this because of this dumb rollout that we have right now that is just too slow.
Is there a so best?
It's almost like the prejudice of people in you know, rich countries who think, okay, well, we're okay, and you know, we'll do some charity later for these other people. It's almost like that prejudice will come back and, you know, bite them on the ass. It really will.
Is there a best in class from a human rights point of view? Is there a country that stands above the rest? Are they all pretty much getting this wrong?
We don't like that. Human Rights Watch doesn't like to rank them in general. I think there hasn't been there may be better and worse, but I mean, we haven't. I don't think anybody comes out looking that great here, to be honest.
Yeah, and particularly the northern countries. They're not coming out great at this at all.
No, I mean, it's really horrible. I mean, like, what they're doing now is completely horrible. And you have on the other side of that debate at the World Trade Organization, you have like 100 countries, or even more than 100 countries, that are pushing for this patent waiver, this TRIPS waiver, so they can get on with production. Closer to where they are, and to boost production globally. Like, there are a lot of people who get it. You know, the experts get it. These 100 plus countries get it. There was just a great letter to President Biden, signed by a lot of former presidents, former prime ministers, Nobel laureates, calling for this same measure. I mean, there's a lot of people who get it. And unfortunately, the people who are blocking it continue to block it.
Sorry, Tony, your mic there.
Just the last thing, we've discussed the TRIPS waiver. We've discussed the crisis. We've had a refugee crisis for long before COVID. One thing that has happened, I suppose, is we keep seeing these things now. I know. I spoke to the commissioner for children in Northern Ireland earlier today, and she spoke about the concept of something good having to emerge from COVID, that there has to be something good that comes from it. We know in the US that Joe Biden has come forward with his, you know, $1 trillion plan to revive these things, and it turns out we're all infrastructure. We know in the EU they're talking about, you know, supercharging a Green New Deal for Europe. In terms of human rights, Is there a couple of things, like lessons, that you think we should all learn from this? And I don't want to put it too fine thing, but what would be the ways, if you were to say, how do we build back fairer? What would be the two or three things that you think everybody should be able to say, well, that's an agreement across say the EU or whichever area we choose to focus on?
Well, I think actually, if we, it sort of speaks exactly to this idea of global cooperation on the pandemic. I mean, if we could get that could develop into, you know, cooperation on a whole range of public health issues around the world, right? I mean, if we can work on, you know, greater vaccine production around the world, and really get that into place, being able to respond to these kind of coronavirus pandemics and being able to respond to new variants emerging. I mean, that would just be such an incredible thing to come out of this. And ultimately, if an infrastructure like that existed around the world, it could over time save millions of lives. It could also be, you know, part of, you know, a greater public health effort on a whole range of issues that affect people globally, that concern everything from fundamental sanitation issues to other vaccines for other diseases. If that came out of it, that'd be great. But if we continue with this kind of, you know, inequality, we're not going to get that. I think if something clicks in people's head that a global pandemic means a global problem that needs a global solution, because honestly, like, none of us are safe until all of us are safe. And if that actually sinks in to some small amount in people's heads globally, that could be, you know, just from a philosophical point of view, something that could be very positive for humanity in the long term. But, you know, we're very far from that right now.
I have to agree with you, Andrew. You know, sometimes it takes a second heart attack to pay attention.
Jeez. I'm putting it strongly. Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming on.
I have one point where we could actually, there's one example we could follow, Andrew, that shows that people can mobilize, they can make a difference, is if we were to call the TRIPS waiver the European Super League and everybody got upset about football, that must have been like, that shows you, you know, we had Boris Johnson straight to action, whereas he was months, you know, talking about herd immunity on COVID, and then he was straight to action when the risk came to Man United and Arsenal. You know, it was.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if you know, it shows you that incredible public mobilization around the world is really possible in a very short time once people understand the, you know, what's going on, and it affects them, you know, something they care about. And I think, you know, that's what we are building, you know, we, Human Rights Watch, but also like so many other organizations, you know, Doctors Without Borders and Oxfam and so many others, People's Vaccine Alliance, are really trying to, you know, if we can get to, you know, one half or even one tenth of that kind of public awareness, enthusiasm and outrage for something that, let's face it, is, you know, I like football, but you know, this is life and death. This is absolutely killing people, like literally killing
but
people.
I think Tony's analogy is good because we're playing it like it's a football match, each country for themselves, you know, and I think...
Well, yeah, that's true. That's exactly right, yeah.
I'll end it. I think it was Jock Steen said, though, football is it's not life and death. It's much more important than that, Martin.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's what we're looking at.
Andrew, thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us, and thank you for the work that you do, and please continue to do the work that you do. We much appreciate it. But thank you again for taking the time to talk to us today.
Martin and Tony, thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for your patience and sticking with us. We will talk to you all soon, folks. We are going to Gaza next to talk to Hanna Salah about what's happening COVID wise. So there'll be more coming. Talk to you all soon.
Good
folks.
Luck.
Take
Good
care.
Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.